You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for being here. So he calls COVID-19 a terrifying harbinger of future pandemics that will be brought about if climate change continues to so deeply destabilize the natural world. We are spending the hour with author David Wallace Wells, and we're looking at the warming planet through the lens of what we're experiencing right now in this outbreak. How has the pandemic changed the way you look at humanity, how you look at our planet? Do you feel like this is the new normal? What needs to change about how we go about this world? Join in at any point in the conversation, 800-642-1234. David Wallace Wells is deputy editor at New York Magazine. He's a former fellow at the think tank New America, and he wrote the 2019 book called The Uninhabitable Earth. David, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks so much for having me. Great to talk.
So you live in New York at this epicenter. As we watch New York, what is life like there? How has your life changed?
Well, I would say the first thing that's happened to me is that my life has been full of a lot more panic and anxiety than it tends to be, even though I'm somebody who spent the last couple of years sort of staring somewhat directly into the face of some apocalyptic futures, writing about climate change, and in particular, the sort of scarier end of what's possible there. Nevertheless, my life has been really upended at a kind of emotional, psychological, and intellectual level by COVID, like I think everyone's has. And while I would have thought that the last couple of years thinking about our possible apocalyptic futures might have prepared me for such an event arriving in the present, it's been, I think, just as destabilizing and disorienting for me as it has for other people. I've been lucky enough to not be touched all that closely by the disease. The people who I know who have been sick are people who I only know tangentially. But the city itself is in a state of real crisis. Things seem, relatively speaking, under control now compared to where they were a few weeks ago. But that's only because of incredibly aggressive lockdown measures. And it's quite scary to think of what might happen when we begin to relax those, as we will probably across the country. At the moment in New York, it's still the case that it's a quite, you know, typically a quite busy, loud city. And you can almost hear nothing now, except from the occasional chirping of birds, which is pretty rare in New York. Usually that's drowned out by other noises. And then the periodic sound of sirens. And even though new hospitalizations, new cases, and new deaths are declining, which is, you know, reason for great appreciation and thankfulness, nevertheless, the city is still in a total crisis state and is defined by both the suffering of those who are sick, the hard work and kind of terrifyingly hard work of those people attending to them, and then all of the rest of us living in a kind of a bunker, peering out through our phones at a world that feels very, very different than the one that we had gotten used to as recently, you know, as a few months ago.
David, it really took my breath away when you wrote last week that we're probably only a tenth of the way through this pandemic. Can you explain what you meant there?
Well, there are basically three ways that we could get to the other side of this. The first is through a vaccine. The second is through really effective treatment, not just treatment that helps patients on the margins, but changes the whole clinical landscape of the disease, meaning that it'll be a lot less scary for us if we get it. And the third is through what's called herd immunity, which is when enough people have been exposed to the disease that they have antibodies that would allow them to fend it off. And as a result, even though some people in the population wouldn't have gotten it, enough people would have that the disease can't really be transmitted through the population at large. And that means that it rapidly slows and even eventually sort of kills off the virus. Taking each of those in turn, the vaccine, you know, some people are hopeful that it might be ready as soon, there might be one ready as soon as September. But typically vaccines take at least several years to develop. No vaccine for any kind of coronavirus has ever been manufactured before. And if we were able to get this one even within a year or 18 months, it would be the fastest from development to deployment vaccine in the history of medicine. So while there are scientists who are hopeful that we could hit that timeline or even beat it, I think it may be a little optimistic to expect anything arriving sooner than a year or so. On the treatment front, you know, we're still in the phase of testing treatments where we're working through medicines that were developed for other diseases and sort of seeing if they happen to help with this one. And there are some instances where things seem promising. There's a drug called remdesivir that, at least in early trials with coronavirus, seems to be helping somewhat dramatically, although there are side effects and the trials are still early. Other ones like hydroxychloroquine, which was promoted so aggressively by President Trump. is proving to be less effective in early trials. But, you know, just keep in mind the kind of drug that would really transform the clinical picture of this disease would probably have to come, would have to be developed in order to treat this disease. I think it's quite unlikely that anything that was developed for other diseases would so radically change the picture of how we treat coronavirus that we would stop worrying about it so dramatically. And those drugs are still in the only the very earliest phases of development, which means they need to be developed, they need to be tested, and that process can take quite a long time, say a year or two at the quickest. So that leaves us with a third option, which is herd immunity. And that happens when, depends on the disease, but in general, epidemiologists believe it happens when somewhere between 60 and 80% of the public has been exposed to the particular disease. And right now, there's some dispute because we've done so little testing all around the world, but especially in the U.S., that we don't really know how many people have gotten the disease. We only know the people who have been gotten sick enough that they show up at hospitals needing a test. But even the most generous estimate of the number of people who've been exposed is about 5% of the American population. I would bet that it's somewhat considerably less than that. But even at 5%, that means that we're only 1/12 of the way to the 60% that's the minimum threshold of herd immunity. And if you take a more sort of median estimate for how many Americans have been exposed, something like 1 or 2%, that means that we could be as far as 1/50th or 1/60th along the path to immunity. And what that means, it means a number of things. I mean, but one big thing for me is that many people I know have sort of been heartened by the good news in New York, the good news in Washington State, the good news in California, that what seemed for a time to be a totally out of control epidemic is flattening out and plateauing, and the hospital systems are able to treat the people who are sick right now. And I think most people watching that then think, oh, we've reached this peak, and now we're going to be on the downslope. We're going to be dealing with a smaller and smaller disease. But the truth is we've only managed to get a handle on things with, you know, a couple percentage points of the population exposed, which means we haven't gotten a handle on the whole possible scope of the disease. And as soon as we start to open things up again, people will begin to be infected again, and we have, again, you know, at least 10 or 12 times farther to go.
And so that's where we get the waves, the next wave, if you will, of this virus.
Yeah, I think, you know, a lot of lay people, it was one way that I thought of it up until a few weeks ago, you know, we hear about waves and we think, oh, maybe it's a disease mutation or it has to do with seasonality. And those things can happen too. Even if we really did defeat the disease, it's possible that it could mutate or come back in a subsequent season or subsequent year in a harsher way that we'd have to reckon with. That's what happened with the 1918 flu, which had a quite severe spring outbreak and then a devastating fall outbreak. But even putting those possibilities aside, we haven't gotten through the first natural wave. We are still, if the only 5% of the public has been exposed, and the only way that we can prevent spread to the population is to literally bunker ourselves into our homes and never leave, I think it's quite likely that over the course of the next few months, we're going to see many more Americans infected.
We're spending the hour with climate journalist David Wallace Wells, why he thinks the coronavirus is perhaps a preview of our climate change future. How has the pandemic changed the way you imagine the future? Are you more pessimistic, more optimistic? What is it like in your bunker, in your corner of the world? We're at 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with David Wallace Wells here on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're talking about climate change and how we look at this pandemic. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. So climate change is described as a threat multiplier, something that worsens existing problems and makes new ones. Earlier this month, we heard the National Academies of Sciences panel. They cautioned that changes in heat and humidity may not affect how COVID-19 spreads. Do you see the coronavirus connected at all to global warming? If so, what parallels can you draw? What do you wonder about how our planet is changing and what viruses have to do with it? Be part of this at 800-642-1234. David Wallace Wells is deputy editor and climate columnist for New York Magazine, and he stays with us. Let's take a call now. Lori is joining us from Green Bay. Hi, Lori.
Hi. You know, we hear about these polar ice caps that are melting, the glaciers and everything. Are there viruses and bacteria under there that we have not been exposed to that could cause a potential problem? And could this possibly be from that, since they kind of don't know where it came from?
Lori, thank you so much. David, there are a million undiscovered viruses in the world. What does that mean for us?
Well, it means that we're probably not prepared for most of them. And the caller, Lori, you're absolutely right. There are diseases that are frozen in the Arctic ice and in permafrost. Some of them have been there for decades, some hundreds of years, some thousands of years, and some millions of years. And while scientists aren't too worried about those diseases escaping as that ice melts, because they think it'll be quite hard for those diseases to survive when the ice melts. In fact, a number of them have been revivified in laboratory conditions. We've had bacteria and diseases, viruses that are millions of years old, that have been frozen for millions of years, that have been thawed out and survived in lab conditions. And we know of at least one case where melting permafrost in Siberia exposed some reindeer carcasses that had been there for about a century. And those reindeer had originally died of anthrax. And when the permafrost thawed, the reindeer thawed, and the anthrax was released, it actually infected a huge number of living reindeer, killing many of them, and also infected at least one Russian boy who died as a result as well. So there is some threat from disease coming out of the melting and retreating ice. But scientists say, in general, compared to all the other public health threats posed by climate change, it's relatively small. You know, for me, the biggest public health issue with climate change is air pollution, which isn't, strictly speaking, a climate impact, but it's produced by the same thing that produces climate change, which is to say the burning of fossil fuels. And The Lancet, the British medical journal, says that about 9 million people are dying every year from air pollution. And in fact, it's tied up with the coronavirus, because a number of recent studies have shown that the more heavily polluted the air is, the more lethal the disease will be in that region. But of course, there are also other things happening with, you know, mosquitoes that used to only live in the tropics, carrying malaria and dengue in relatively limited areas, will be flying as far north as the Arctic Circle in a few decades, which means we may be reckoning with malaria and dengue in places like New York City and Stockholm before too long. And of course, the story of COVID is, at least as we understand it, the origin story of the disease is still, as the caller mentioned, a little unclear. But the conventional narrative is a familiar one to those studying the origin of diseases, which is to say that in general, habitat destruction and the scrambling of ecosystems means that more animals are being brought into contact with humans that never were in contact before. And viruses and bacteria, which had been living in a kind of a quarantine in a particular stable region, they have those areas, their natural landscapes, destabilized, and they start to travel. And that's one of the main reasons why we have pandemics of any kind. In fact, it's been said by epidemiologists that all pandemics throughout all history are the result of globalization and the human disruption of the natural world, because before that kind of large-scale travel, even the kind that we saw sort of in the 15th, 16th century, a disease could arise, but it would really just affect a particular area or a particular region. It's only now, because we're so connected and because we're remaking and disrupting so much of the natural world, that we're starting to see these diseases travel all around the globe. The 1918 flu was maybe the first really dramatic example of a truly global pandemic, but even the Black Death in Europe in the Middle Ages, in the early modern period, that wouldn't have traveled in the way that it did if those countries and communities hadn't been networked much more than they had been 1,000 years before or 2,000 years before.
We're talking with David Wallace Wells, deputy editor at New York Magazine, where he frequently writes about our warming planet, with your questions along the way at 800-642-1234. David, you know, Zika is another example, moving out of a confined small region of the world. But after it moved out of that area, it started to become much more serious on people. What do you see there with Zika? And is there anything that we could, you know, look at our pandemic today and how it is moving and how we should address it?
Well, Zika is an interesting story in part because I don't think we really understand what happened there. The relationship between the disease and the birth defects in particular that so alarmed so many of us when they were first being reported, it's not exactly clear what the causal mechanism is there. And in a number of regions of the world, Zika has been quite pervasive for quite a long time without causing anything like that level of problems. So it's possible that the disease mutated as it traveled around the world. It's possible that it produced those defects, those birth defects, and those other issues only when it arrived in a human host that was dealing with some other disease that we don't know about or had some other pre-existing condition that we don't know about. I think it's all quite unclear, but I think it's a kind of illustrative example generally of how much we really don't know about so many of the viruses and bacterias. Even those that we're quote unquote familiar with are still behaving in some quite mysterious ways. And that goes doubly or maybe even triply or more for a disease like the coronavirus, where, you know, we're only really, depending on how you count, maybe five months into any human focus on this disease at all. And there are huge questions about exactly what it is and how it affects us and how it produces the outcomes that we're seeing, such that, you know, the age skews vary significantly from country to country. In some places, the young are almost totally invulnerable. In other cases, they have a more robust response than the elderly, but they certainly are vulnerable themselves. In certain places, we're seeing that, you know, for instance, having been a smoker protects you against continuing to be a smoker protects you, but having quit smoking makes you vulnerable. These are things we really don't understand. We don't understand how many people in the population have been affected. We don't know whether it's 10 times the number of confirmed cases, which is sort of that's the standard rule of thumb these days, or 5 times or 50 times.
So many questions. And, you know, we humans have come to see ourselves as, you know, living outside of nature, but global warming, as you have written about, makes that attitude impossible. Is this pandemic an example of the natural world encroaching on our civilization?
I would put it sort of the other way. It's an example of what happens in the natural world when we encroach on it. But I think the dynamic is basically as you describe, and I feel this way very much myself. I'm a lifelong New Yorker. I'm born in 1982, grew up mostly in the 1990s. And I walked down those concrete streets my whole life, looking up at those skyscrapers and thought nature was something that, you know, I could look at in a postcard or go visit on a vacation, but it wasn't where I lived. I lived in a man-made environment. I lived outside the natural world. And in fact, humanity as a whole, over many centuries of what I thought of as progress, had taken dominion over the natural world, which we were now sort of lording over in a quite direct way. And the more that I've spent time learning about climate change, the more I see it in really opposite terms. It may sound like a totally naive revelation, but to me, it was quite profound that no matter where you live, no matter who you are, no matter how wealthy you are, what country you're in, you are living in the natural world and indeed are subject to its whims and occasionally to its brutality. And coronavirus is just another illustration of that. I think it's an especially vivid one because it happened so quickly and within just a few months has completely upended not just our individual lives and hasn't just infected and, you know, imposed so much suffering on so many people all around the world. It's also really changed the landscape, the entire landscape of modern life, in the sense that many things that we took to be sort of permanent, eternal features of advanced civilization and the contemporary world are being shown to be totally fragile. You know, we're none of us going to work. We're none of us traveling. You know, even the behavior of governments, you know, we've seen in the U.S. A Republican Party that's been quite resistant to social welfare spending, taking seriously the idea of a universal basic income, talking about possibly taking ownership over airlines in exchange for bailout money. These are political developments that we would have thought were unthinkable just a short time ago. And to me, the most dramatic thing that's happened is that we've entered into this it's not just a national lockdown. It's basically a hemisphere-wide lockdown where billions of people in every country of the Northern Hemisphere are now shuttered into their own homes to protect themselves, yes, but also out of concern for others. Because even the dramatic estimates of the case fatality rate here say only 1% or 2% of the public could die, which means almost everybody is doing it out of concern for those around them, not just themselves. And that's breathtaking to me.
We're talking with New York Magazine climate journalist and author David Wallace Wells for the hour about the instability of our planet, what lessons we can learn in the midst of a pandemic. Has the pandemic changed the way you imagine your future? Are you more pessimistic, more optimistic? Do you see hope in how your neighbors are helping each other out? Join in at any point, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. We'll be back with David Wallace Wells right after this news update here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Just a quick thank you to everyone who donated during our spring member drive. Support from people like Adam from Green Bay sustains the trusted news and information you value here on the Ideas Network. To ensure the resources are in place, we do fundraise throughout the year, which has all been affected at this time. So if you missed the spring drive, your gift now at WPR.org is especially important. And thank you so much for your support. Right now, we're talking about our warming planet and how to view it in the face of this pandemic. There's this new Harvard study that looked at exposure to air pollution and COVID-19 mortality. It found that people living in polluted environments are far less able to fight off the disease. Do you think that the pandemic is related to global warming? Are you concerned that there will be more pandemics like this in the future? Join in at 800-642-1234. We have David Wallace Wells for the hour. He's deputy editor and climate columnist for New York Magazine. Let's take another call now. Emily is joining us from West Bend this morning. Hi, Emily.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I was just calling in because you were looking for ways that this pandemic has changed our society for the better. And I was mourning the loss of getting to know one's neighbors. I felt like in the past, there had been this real connection between neighborhoods. And then it seemed like with the rise of the internet age, there had become this fear. And I'm not sure if it was because everybody was just kind of holed up in front of their computer, and then everybody was talking about the news, and everyone had just kind of shuttered themselves off. But now there's this revitalization of neighborhoods. I feel like people are really coming together and getting to know the people that live next to them and just hanging out and being good neighbors. And I'm so glad to see the return of that.
Emily, thank you for bringing that. You know, in the absence of human-to-human contact, there's more connection, David.
I think that's certainly true in parts of the world and in ways that we have to try to feel inspired by. You know, the truth is the fact that so many people are committing to these quarantine measures and these social distancing measures, as painful as it may be to them, I think is a sign of real fellow feeling. That's an empathy and a sense of, you know, universalism and humanitarianism that as recently as a few months ago would have struck many people, not just our caller, as almost unthinkable in maybe especially in the U.S. as divided by politics as we often are and as often as we feel we're sort of waging a cold cultural civil war in this country. The pandemic has shown us our universal fate, how much we share the risks together. Even if they're distributed unequally through the population, nobody is immune. And I think it's quite powerful the way that we've collectively responded to try to take even quite painful action to protect one another.
Those may also be the types of feelings you should have in terms of approaching global warming, that it is these individual acts. If everyone acts, that real steps can be taken to combat the warming climate.
Well, I think it's absolutely the sort of emotional orientation that I would want to suggest you take in approaching the challenge of climate change. I think that, you know, the more that we can think of our common humanity and our common fate, the fact that we are living on this one planet, which is being transformed much more rapidly than has ever been the case in the entire history of the planet, in ways that have already taken us outside the zone of climate conditions that have governed for all of human history, which means we're already living in an unprecedented climate situation, and things are going to get dramatically more different from here. I think all of that requires us to think about what we need to do to protect one another and to secure the future that we all hold together on this planet. You know, my own feeling about the lessons of the shutdown are almost the opposite of the one that you imply, in the sense that, you know, I think that these are measures that, while are being enacted by individuals, are most effective because they are being managed at a much larger scale. If it was just up to individuals to take quarantine measures, some people would do that, and that would help on the margins. But to the extent that we're deploying these policies and these behaviors to really, really change the shape of this pandemic, which is what we've done, it's not just because 5 or 10% of the public is quarantining themselves voluntarily. It's because we've collectively agreed in ways that have been encouraged and then enforced by our public authorities to do this collectively and indeed universally. And I think that we should do well to transport that that model to the climate challenge, because, you know, if we want to stabilize the planet's temperature at any temperature level, even a quite warm, hellish one, it requires us not just to reduce our emissions, it requires us to cut them all the way to zero. Because if in 5 years from now, or 50 years from now, we're at 3 or 4 degrees of warming and we're suffering in all the ways that we know that that will impose suffering on us, and we're only emitting just 10% of the carbon we're emitting today, we will still be heating the planet warmer from there. And in order to get all the way to zero, I think it requires us to take collective action through public policy, because unless you expect every single person on the planet to voluntarily go vegan and never eat another piece of red meat again, or every single person on the planet in every country of the world to never set foot on an airplane again, then that means that we need instead some kind of public policy that will allow us to eat meat, those of us who want to, that was raised in a carbon neutral way or even a carbon negative way that absorbs carbon out of the atmosphere, and that allows us to step on airplanes and travel, especially those of us living in parts of the world that are for the first time becoming wealthy enough to afford that travel, get on airplanes that are flying on a different kind of fuel that don't produce the carbon emissions that today's airplanes do. And those are the changes I think we need, and they're at a scale that I think can only really be achieved through public policy and true collective action. Individual action helps us move in that direction, but ultimately, we need much, much bigger action than any individual or even a mass of individuals can manage.
We're talking with David Wallace Wells. He wrote the book, The Uninhabitable Earth. He's a climate journalist. We're looking at the warming planet in the midst of this pandemic. With your thoughts as well at 800-642-1234. So, David, we have the knowledge, we have the technology we need to essentially feed a larger population and provide energy for all people. It is possible to reverse some of the effects of climate change. So what is the disconnect here? What is holding us back?
Well, I think it's a complicated question, which has many different answers, all of which contribute to some degree. But I would start with the fact that this is relatively new knowledge. You know, scientists really first broadcast it to the public in the late 1980s, which means we're about 30 years in. And that is that's a long time on some level, but it's, you know, in terms of really a new perspective to take hold in the imaginations and the political consciousness of the planet as a whole, it's not that much time. The bad news is, over that period of time, over those 30 years, we've actually done more damage in terms of carbon emissions than we managed in all of the centuries, indeed all the millennia that came before. So half of the problem or more of climate change has been produced not in ignorance, but knowingly. And that's scary in terms of how we'll respond going forward. I think it's also true that for a long time we were told these changes were happening slowly. They were happening in limited ways and in distant places. We heard a lot about Arctic melt and sea level rise. And that meant that if you lived anywhere by the coast, you could feel safe. And it was really a problem that we were told would affect mostly our grandchildren, which gave us quite a lot of time to get a handle on it.
Some other generation's problem, or some other person's problem who is living in the wrong place, for instance.
Exactly. And the more that we know about this challenge and the problems it will cause, the more we know about the impacts on agricultural yields, which could theoretically fall in half by the end of the century, or economic activity, which could be cut by 30% by the end of the century if we don't change course, or wildfires, or flooding that we've had in the Midwest the last couple of years, hurricanes, et cetera. The more that we're seeing those impacts on our television news now in real time the last couple of years, the more people are starting to understand that this is a present tense threat, which we need to take action against today. But even so, we have a disinclination to really take seriously scary prospects for the future. And when we think about the future, we sort of anchor our expectations on our experience of the present. And so we look at our windows and we look, you know, we watch the TV news and we think, well, things are getting worse, but they're not that much worse than they used to be. And that means that we expect the same to continue in the future. But this is a problem that is getting worse every day. And 10 years from now, 20 years from now, it's going to be dramatically worse. So we can't base our expectations for that future on the world we have today. The world we have today is inevitably going to be lost. The question is how much worse it gets from here. And ultimately, that is a question for us. It's a political question for us. What kind of actions will we take from here? What kind of measures will we take? And I think on some level, the rapid response that we've engineered to COVID-19 globally is encouraging in that way. We have seen really dramatic government action, really dramatic public opinion shifts on these issues over the course of just a few months.
And let's theoretically, I'm going to jump in here and bring in another call, Lois in DeForest. Lois, hi.
Hi. Was asked the question by the screener and I didn't answer it very well, but the COVID-19 has also affected our higher use of single-use plastics when we go to the grocery store. And I was talking about it because plastics is, to me, a really huge issue. And so my great nephew told me that I could wheel the grocery cart out to my car, not use the single-use plastic, and just put it in the trunk of my car, which I thought was a great idea. So I am on our Nextdoor Neighbor app just spreading that kind of information. I know I'm only one person, but I'm trying to really help more and more people think about, you know, our lives and everyday actions that we take.
Lois, thank you for the call. Lois, in this time, not able to use those reusable bags, able to wheel the groceries without putting them in plastic to Lois's vehicle. Talking with David Wallace Wells, our guide to our warming planet this hour, looking at climate change in the pandemic. With your insights, what gives you hope that you didn't have before the COVID-19 pandemic? 800-642-1234. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. We'll be back in just a minute. More conversation here on the Ideas Network. The morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. So here's the thing. The power of one person to do a good thing is quite remarkable. And in the months and years to come, when scientists develop a vaccine for COVID-19, how do you take those wins and keep applying them to the planet? How do you build on positive momentum? That's something to watch for. Still time for you, 800-642-1234. We have climate journalist and author David Wallace Wells, who stays with us. Let's take another call now. Vern is joining us from Boyd this morning. Hi, Vern.
Oh, good morning. Thanks for letting me on. I appreciate this. Okay, as to global warming, for one, the air is too clean, so it lets more sunlight in. The number one cause of the greenhouse gas effect on the surface of the Earth is aircraft. Number two is wetlands and methane. Methane is 80 times more powerful than CO2. And unless you're going to eliminate about 3 billion people, CO2 is going to increase forever. But aircraft travel, if you would ground all the aircraft travel, for one, we wouldn't have the coronavirus here to begin with to that extent. And that's the contrails of aircraft are the major cause of the surface of the Earth warming up because they form ice crystals so the heat can't get back out. And we go through solar cycles. I calculated one back 7 centuries. and it comes out to within like 4 hours. We go through these.
Vern, I want to jump in here and allow David to respond to your thesis. David, what do you make of it?
Well, air travel is the biggest contributor to carbon emissions for probably people like you and me and the caller, people who live in the relatively well-off countries of the world and who travel a fair bit. Globally, it's actually a tiny sliver of the problem. It's depending on how you calculate 2 or 3% of carbon emissions. And those impacts can be slightly higher. It's been estimated by some recent research because the carbon is being emitted higher in the atmosphere. But effectively, it's a relatively small part of the problem as a whole. Much bigger are electricity generation, transportation, industry, agriculture, and infrastructure. And we can make progress there. We don't have to, you know, the population of the planet is one thing that drives economic activity. And at the moment, our economic system depends on carbon. So the more people, the more growth, the more emissions. But theoretically, we could redesign our system so that wasn't the case. You know, if our electricity was produced by solar or wind or nuclear, then we could have many more people on the planet using much more power without imposing any carbon cost on the future. And that's, I think, what we have to aim for.
Let's bring in Jean now in Fort Atkinson with thoughts on this. Hi, Jean.
Hi. I'm just calling because I just kind of think that because of our overpopulation, this is the response from nature just to try to control our population when we just are unable to do it, it seems.
So you see the pandemic as a response to our population growth around the world?
Yeah, I do.
David, what do you make of that?
Well, I think, I think at the moment, our best understanding of the origin of the disease is that it came about in part because of increased interaction between humans and bats in a particular region in China. And that is the result of development and growth, which is a product of population growth. So I think to some degree, it's true that the more that we deforest the world, the more that we disrupt natural habitats and ecosystems in order to build more and more habitats for ourselves, the more problems like this that we're likely to see in the future. That said, I think in general, the planet as a whole can support considerably more people than we have today in every way if we manage that growth in an intelligent way. The problem is at the moment, we're so dependent on fossil fuels to provide for all of us that any amount of population growth is imposing a carbon cost on the future. But as I mentioned a minute ago, it doesn't have to be that way. We are already making the changes to that system at a relatively small scale. And a lot of those changes are quite encouraging. The price of renewable energy is falling so that it's now cost competitive with dirty energy in most parts of the world, for instance. The problem is we're making those changes not nearly fast enough to avert what the scientists call catastrophic warming of about 2 degrees of warming. And I think that level of warming is probably inevitable given the trajectory on and how slowly we're making the changes that we need to make. The question is, how much warmer than 2 degrees will things get before we really get a handle on this crisis?
If you're just joining us, we're talking with David Wallace Wells. He's deputy editor at New York Magazine, who writes frequently about climate change. Let's bring in another call. Anthony is with us from Toma this morning. Hi, Anthony.
Hello, thank you for taking my call. So I work retail, and one of the things that sold out first were a lot of the canned vegetables, a lot of vegetables and just various forms. And it got me thinking, is a plant-based, lifestyle, the more we go more towards plants, does that have a more positive impact on our planet than, say, animal agriculture?
Anthony, thank you for that question. David, what is the impact of a plant-based diet?
Well, it definitely moves us in the right direction. In general, plants are incredible machines for absorbing carbon out of the atmosphere and turning it into oxygen. And when we eat them, we don't release that carbon. So unlike in a forest fire, when trees burn, they release the carbon they've stored up. When we eat plants, we just absorb that carbon. And so in general, a plant-based diet is much is much more responsible climate-wise than one that's dominated by animal agriculture. But there are ways of raising animal proteins as well that could make those proteins considerably less carbon intensive. If you feed cows methane, if you feed cows seaweed, their methane emissions go down by 95% or 99%. And if you use traditional pasturing practices, you can turn cattle farms from carbon, what are called carbon sources that produce carbon, into carbon sinks that absorb them. So there are ways of working with animal agriculture to make it more responsible and allow us to engineer a relatively stable climate future even while eating meat. But in general, yes, the more that we base our diet around plants, the better off we'll be. Unfortunately, the truth is that the trends in the world are moving in the other direction, because so many populations, so many nations that are finally pulling themselves out of real poverty over the last couple of decades, now that they're at a kind of state of new global middle-classness, want to enjoy that experience by eating the kind of foods that people in the wealthy parts of the world have always eaten. And so you see huge growth in the consumption of animal agriculture, of animal proteins in Asia and South Asia. And that'll probably be problematic for the future if we don't figure out a way to raise those proteins in a more responsible way.
David, I understand that your first child was born while you were writing The Uninhabitable Earth. How do you think we should be talking with our kids about climate change?
Well, I think we should be straight with them and real. And I think that we should, be unafraid to talk about how much the planet is likely to look different in the decades ahead. And I think, just to give a very quick sense for your listeners, I mentioned earlier, we are already outside the window of temperatures that enclose human history. So climate conditions have never been like this before when humans were around to experience them, which means everything we've ever known as a species is the result of climate conditions that we've already left behind. It's like we've landed on a new planet and have to figure out what of the civilization we've brought with us can survive these new conditions and what will have to be adapted. Those adaptations will be necessary. We'll be making them together, and our children will be making even more of them. But ultimately, the most important thing I think we can, the most important lesson we can leave our children is not anything particular about the state of the climate or what needs to be done. It's just to try to introduce to them a sense of genuine and universal human empathy. Because I think one of the major risks going forward is that as warming continues, as suffering from climate change grows, that we choose to respond to that, especially in places like the US and Western Europe, by turning away from those who are suffering most in the developing world and the global South, and instead focusing on securing our own well-being, even at the expense of those people. And I think we already have that tendency in us at a social level, at a political level, and it's terrible now. But we need to fight against it even more the more those people will be suffering in the decades ahead. So I think more than anything else, empathy is the most important value to pass along.
David, thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
David Wallace Wells, a deputy editor at New York Magazine who writes about climate change. We've been discussing the COVID-19 pandemic. If you missed any part of our conversation, you can stream it. You can download it later today at WPR.org/mornings. Just ahead, it's On Point. Doctors and nurses are fighting the biggest health crisis in a century. So why are healthcare workers in some hospitals being laid off? We talk about the COVID-19 pandemic and what it's revealing about running hospitals as a business. That's On Point. Just ahead, I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.